Well, good morning. It's a real pleasure to be here with you today. It's a difficult topic to be talking about, but very encouraging to see so many people here from so many different sectors in the community. It's wonderful. The very brief intro of who I am, Rob Balick. I'm a pharmacist by training, advanced training in epidemiology. I've been at CU for the last 25 years working on this topic, and even back to pharmacy school in the mid-80s. This is the one thing that I've been working on for 30 years, so it's I don't know a whole lot about much, but I do know a whole lot about one thing, and it's the opioid thing. So it's about you've touched on the one thing that I know anything at all about, so you're lucky. I'm a native Coloradan, so I've been to 62 of the 64 counties, 58 of them in the last 2 years, again, dealing with this issue. So I view all of Colorado as important to me. I'm a native and have gotten around. My good friend of mine lives across the street in Basalt. Sister used to live in Marble and Carbondale for 15 years, so I've been up here many, many times, and you know, think this is a wonderful, if I could live wherever I wanted to, you know, I'd probably be very close to right here. So I have a strong affinity for being here, and I appreciate the chance to come and talk with you. So we'll just dive right in with what the current data are showing on how big this thing is. The most recent data we have federally are from 2016. Everything else from 2017 is preliminary and little slices that you're hearing little previews about. But the 2016 data, over 63,000 people in the United States died from drug overdoses, you know, one every 10 minutes. So six more during this talk. And actually, based on the data that we're seeing, it's going to be more like seven or eight during this talk right now, based on the way things are trending. About two-thirds of those are involving prescription drugs of some kind. Virtually all of those, three-quarters of those, involve opioids. So the big driver is the prescribed opioid drugs for especially getting people started. We're seeing a lot of other things increase, but still the common gateway is prescribed opioids. In Colorado, there were 912 drug overdose deaths in 2016. Of those, 504 were opioid involved, the number that we track at the statewide consortium for the prescription drug abuse part. And we look at those, and that's the prescribed ones like oxycodone or OxyContin, Vicodin or Narco, which is hydrocodone, or other similar prescribed drugs. That's the legal ones, or all the illegal ones combined, like fentanyl, heroin, illicitly obtained drugs or illicitly manufactured drugs. You combine those two and you get this number that we look at, this 504 number, and we track that. So that's, you know, for us, about 42 a month are dying, more than one a day dying from one of these. And we think that the number is vastly underreported because many causes of death that are coded are, you know, cardiac arrest or that kind of thing. They're just not coded as the end result. From what the overdose is. Many coroner counties don't do a lot of autopsies on things, don't have budget to do autopsies for everybody. You know, we're a coroner state, don't have a lot of medical examiners, so the data are you know, never perfect, and we think the numbers are probably much, much greater than those. That's just what we have good confirmation on. The provisional data from 2017 that I can talk about that are not final, but again from CDPHE, are that 536 were opioid involved, so the number's already a 5% increase. And I looked at the fourth quarter provisional data, and they're not anywhere near complete, because there's a giant drop, there's nothing drops by 40% in a quarter. So we're seeing that, you know, as the reporting gets completed and they certify the data from 2017, it's going to be higher than that. It'll probably be 8% increase, which is the standard growth that we've been seeing over the last 12 years, about 8% a year. And it's probably going to continue that way. The prescription drug opioids are rising again. So that's just like the oxycodones and hydrocodones alone. If there's an isolated report, that was 329 a couple years ago, down to 300, but now back up to 357. And people thought we turned that corner, and really it's just the blips as you see gradual growth over the years. If you look at the trend, the curve has not been bent. People say that it has, and it really hasn't been bent yet. Heroin deaths are what look to be flat, but again, the fourth quarter data were like, you know, 30. There's not 30 in a quarter. After all this growth, we suddenly didn't drop to 30. So when we see the certified data, this number's going to be higher. Fentanyl, even with the incomplete data, something very troubling, even with incomplete fourth quarter data, fentanyl deaths are up from 49 to 74 in a year. That number's going to be over 100 when it's certified. So it's going to be another doubling. We're kind of at a doubling rate where we are right now with fentanyl stuff, and it's increasing it year over year. It's about 100% increases in fentanyl. So it's extremely troubling. People say fentanyl has not really hit Colorado. I strongly disagree that absolutely it has. And this is, again, with limited reporting and limited availability to detect it. So we're already seeing the signal that it's here. And you talk to, you know, enough folks, you talk to enough people at, you know, coroner's offices or MEs or law enforcement or anybody at, you know, emergency departments, anyone really will tell you, yeah, we're seeing it. And we just don't know exactly how big it is, but that we're seeing it. So it's a concern. Methadone deaths are relatively stable. You know, the diverted methadone kind of question is always there. What do we do with a methadone clinic? And isn't there going to be a lot of diversion? Isn't the death rate going to go up sharply from that? We really don't see that. Those numbers haven't changed much in a long period. It's much smaller fluctuations. So maybe a tiny bit of an increase, but, you know, it's not like, oh, geez, there's the big problem over there. It's not diverted methadone. It really is not. And the problem really knows no bounds. You know, the CDC says this is a top four epidemic. It doesn't matter if you're urban or rural, black, white, or Latina. It does not matter. It doesn't, male, female, rich or poor. It really doesn't matter. It's affecting everyone, and it's the level of cancer, heart disease, obesity, prescription drug, opioid overdose death. Now, we should treat it like that, that we're in an epidemic level like those. It's believed to be the single largest piece of a puzzle that is contributing to the deaths of despair that you hear about and read about, that for the first time in the last 55 years, our life expectancy has gone down 2 years in a row in the United States. And it's the single biggest factor. There are several factors. But when you analyze the data, the single largest driver among them is the prescription opioid overdose death. That's decreasing our life expectancy, which is mind-boggling with the progress we have in medical science and public health and health and all of that, that we could be taking a step backwards is really almost unfathomable. If you look at overdose mortality in Colorado, and these are stolen, you know, from the CHI, the Colorado Health Institute, any fancy graphic that I have is not mine because I can't do that. I do black and white slides, and you know, you can see what I do already. But the drug overdose mortality rates back in 2002 looked like this, and the medium color of this orange range, like El Paso and Teller and Fremont counties, kind of that color, is about average, corresponding to the national average. Things that are lighter, shaded, or below the national average, and darker already in the San Luis Valley and the lower Arkansas Valley, are things higher than the national average in terms of the overdose death rate. And I will try to see if this make this work, that you watch this activate this over a 12-year period, and the darker you get is worse, so that by 2014, you see virtually everywhere in the state is substantially above the national average. Some places in Colorado, the San Luis Valley and the lower Arkansas Valley, are 3.5 times the national average. It's not West Virginia bad. It's not Ohio bad. It's not like that quite, but not that far behind, really. And you talk to anyone in the San Luis Valley, and I do all the time. Good friends there, they, you know, have been dealing with this. When I was in pharmacy school, it's not important when, but way back when I was in pharmacy school, I was talking to them then saying, we got a serious problem. We got an opioid problem. And this is 1984, but they're telling me that. So this is not a new thing. It's just that every county is affected now. You can see this. You know, the only reason Mineral County isn't affected is, you know, the four people that live in Creed. If one of them had an opioid overdose death, it would be black in the county. So it would go from white to black, and they only have two colors there possible because of the small sample size. So really, it's not like, boy, what's going on in Mineral County? So I told them, we all gathered for coffee one day, all five of us, and said, you know, just don't anybody do that, because then you're going to be the worst in the state. You're going to go from best to worst like in a half an hour. So don't do it. So the bad news is this is a fivefold increase in a 12-year period for a single cause of death. That just doesn't happen for anything that we deal with. You know, even things that we're thinking we're just doing better detection on or whatever, we just don't see fivefold rates of increase in any cause of death. You know, again, my training's in epi, and when we see this stuff, I'm like, man, that makes no sense. Something serious is going on when that happens. That's a serious cause for alarm, and that's why CDC is so alarmed about it, and we all should be. Drug overdose death rates in the United States, in fact, you know, have surpassed other things that we think of as common cause of death, like motor vehicle traffic deaths of all causes. So this is drunk driving or any crashes as a cause of death. And those are going down because of all the things we try to do to address that with better, you know, with seatbelt laws and airbags and better designed cars and guardrails and speed limits, all the kinds of public healthy things that we do to try to drive that rate down. Firearm-related deaths are actually, as a cause of death, you know, recent events notwithstanding, as a cause of death, are not increasing. you know, our population is growing much, much faster than the rate of firearm-related death. It's still very troubling. I'm not saying that. But as a cause of death and an increasing one, the one that's really driving all this is the drug poisoning deaths. They're called drug poisoning to the CDC. But overdose deaths are really what's driving them. They've surpassed those other two. And that gets the attention of a lot of people, including our governor here, when he says, you know, that's not acceptable that this rate of death is going up that fast. We have to do something. And really, as I mentioned, what's driving that is the prescription opioid overdose deaths. It's not stuff like, well, gee, even as much as cocaine or heroin or other stuff is driving, you know, several thousand deaths. The prescription drug overdoses and then benzodiazepines that are usually on board at the same time, vast majority of them are polydrug overdoses, multiple drug overdoses, like one or more opioids, one or more benzodiazepines, and alcohol is by far the most common scenario you will see. It's very, very rare that you see an isolated single drug overdose. Just extremely rare. But as frightening as that all is, which I think it's very alarming, for every one of those overdose deaths, of the 33,000 that were opioid-related, there are 10 treatment admissions for abuse, 32 emergency department visits related to this. So this is for an overdose or a consequence of an abscess from injection drug use or something related to substance use disorder for the reason for the admission, 32 of those. 130 people who meet criteria for a substance use disorder. And to me, most troubling of all, is this sort of entry point, is the people that report non-medical use of opioids in the last year. For every one of those 33,000 deaths, there's 825 people who admit non-medical use of an opioid in the last year. And those are the people who are at risk of moving through that chain. If I'm using this non-medically, I'm obviously not under the direction of a doctor to use this for a legitimate purpose. And so now I might go off the rails pretty easily. I'm not being monitored by anybody. So I'm not, you know, I have dosage increases and tolerance and dependence, and ultimately addiction, and ultimately have one of these terrible things happen. And that's what we're really concerned about, is this front end that people then can move through this and progress. And if this number stays high, you know, we're not going to see it. It's just a progression, like a mouse moving through a snake. You know, once you're in on this, very hard to move back out and crawl out the mouth. It's very difficult to do. It can be done, but it's hard to do. And the farther and farther you get into the snake, the harder it is to go back. And it really is. You know, so we're seeing that as things are moving along now, and why these overdose death rates are going up so much is all the people who were exposed from the early 90s until about 2010, until we started to get a handle on what's going on. So it's a 20-year period of people getting fed into this kind of a situation. The Alterum Institute, just in the last few weeks, released their best estimate on what this has cost our country in terms of the cost of the opioid epidemic specifically, just the opioid part. This isn't all substance use. But the opioids alone from 2001 to 2016, in that same roughly period I was showing you, the overdose death increases, cost our United States economy $1 trillion. In the next 4 years, it'll be another $500 billion. And then the next 3 years after that, another $500 billion. So the time compression is happening. So that we'll see this every 5 to 6 years, it'll be another trillion in terms of impact on us. Now we're talking national defense kind of numbers, or, you know, build a wall kind of numbers, which I'm not an advocate for building a wall. If you talk about where do you want to spend $1 trillion, let's spend $1 trillion on figuring out how to get people treatment and do prevention so we don't have this problem. So, like this crowd, I mean, I'm sure this crowd would agree with that. But, you know, that's what we need to be doing, because this is the impact it's having on us. Is tremendous. It's not a small problem at all. Even the current White House estimates are about $500 billion. What's this costing us a year? So their numbers are slightly higher than this from the current administration, saying that the impact may even be $504 billion a year. Staggering numbers. And, you know, and what's the last layer of difficulty is that we'd like to be able to get all those folks into treatment, all those folks that need it. And we have about a 90% treatment gap. Depending on which payer it is, like last night I was at the State House listening to some testimony, and in that setting they were reporting a 91% treatment gap. But it's roughly 90% around the country. People that want and need treatment cannot get it, 9 out of 10. If that were true with cancer, 9 out of 10 people diagnosed with cancer go to the cancer center and you say, sorry, only 1 out of 10 gets chemo or radiation or any form of surgery. Sorry, 9 out of 10 of you, we just can't treat you. or people don't know where to go for their cancer treatment, or people are stigmatized because they got cancer, or for all the various reasons, but 9 out of 10 cannot get treatment. So that's another very troubling thing. There's very few buprenorphine prescribers in Colorado. We're working very hard to try to remedy that. There were about 300 of them two and a half years ago. We've worked hard in collaboration with the various folks at CU and with the Office of Behavioral Health and others. We've trained 249 new ones in the last 9 months, docs to get their X waiver to prescribe buprenorphine. So that's progress. But, you know, we need about 10 times that, you know, so it's we have a long way to go to close that gap. But it's a start. Not easy access no matter where you are in Colorado. So, you know, even though there is more in the more concentrated urban areas, it's not like, gee, oh, we got that figured out. And you know, you can just walk in and it's treatment on demand. You can do it just like you would for anything else. No, far from it anywhere you go. So we have a huge problem with treatment capacity. Despite the good work that people are doing, they will tell you. No way are they resourced well enough. No way can we meet all the unmet need. There's just no way, and we need to do everything we can to try to address that. So how did we get here? I just think it's a simple thing. Three-word answer. Follow the opioids. We've really hit the gas pedal in the last 25 years in this country with prescribing and using opioids for virtually every form of pain. In that same span of time that I showed you the overdose death rate increase, we've had a fourfold increase in the quantity of opioids that we prescribe and dispense per capita in the United States. So we quadrupled that in that same period of time, just the amount of opioids we use and the way we use them. And that's really frightening because that led to, a couple years ago, 259 million prescriptions going out at retail for opioids in the United States in 2013. Enough for every American adult to have a bottle of pills every year in their medicine cabinet. On average, there's 55 tablets dispensed. On average, people take 5. So if you do the math, 259 million times 50 tabs left over in the medicine cabinets every year are 10 billion tablets. Sitting in medicine cabinets all around the country. And people wonder, where's the heroin coming from? Where's that, you know, why we have to shut down the fentanyl shipments in the United States. We have a problem from within, that most of the stuff and most of where people start is from those leftovers in the medicine cabinet. It's a very, very concerning thing. That's by far the most common entry to this. And where that happens, where you see more drug, you see more treatment admissions, you see more overdose deaths, you just see them follow one behind the other. We know it's complicated, and I certainly couldn't have put this graph together myself. This is from NIDA. But it's not just the drug. There's obviously biologic and genetic factors that drive people. We're trying to do that kind of research now to figure out what the addicted brain looks like. How do we identify it, and how do we steer people with an addictive brain away from anything like that? So we just avoid that. And, you know, like we would somebody who has renal failure, we would not give them a drug that's going to have to be metabolized by their kidneys. We wouldn't do that because we're going to kill them. So we want to do the same thing. We want to be able to avoid things. Then when we have a known risk factor, and they say that would be a contraindication, we just couldn't use opioids in that person. And we will get there. We're just not there yet. The environment obviously plays a huge factor. This crowd knows all about risk and protective factors, and how we can try to impact this in the most meaningful way is to address those and decrease the need for substance use in general. And that's where we're going to make the most gains, is going to be in prevention. But it's always the last, you know, the ugly stepchild for funding. Always is, always has been, probably will be, unfortunately. But that's what we need to be doing, is preventing people from going down this pathway in the first place. And then the drugs are very complex, people just don't realize some of the nuances about them. Your tolerance starts to build very early. Even 3 weeks into taking an opioid, and you stop taking one, people report it all the time. Hip replacement surgery, shoulder surgery, got opioids, took them for about 3 weeks, decided I'll stop taking them. Boy, when I stopped taking them, I thought I had the flu. Didn't have the flu, you had junior varsity opioid withdrawal. That's what it feels like. It feels like the flu. It just feels like it's going to kill you if you're on heroin long enough. The flu is going to make you want to wish you were dead. It's that bad. But it's really, you're starting withdrawal. First dose, your body starts to make compensatory changes on first dose. So it's not something that, I need to take. I didn't take them for a year, so I can't have any changes to my body. Not true. And most people don't know that stuff about the drugs. They're more complicated and more powerful than people think. And then the brain mechanisms for understanding how addiction works, it's basically the reward circuitry and the reward pathway with dopamine and other neurotransmitters, but it's better understood than it ever has been. But we still don't have the switches go in this order, 1, 4, 3, 9, 6, boom, then there you go, now you're addicted. We don't have that level of understanding. But again, we're getting there and trying to figure that out. So how did we get into this whole mess of prescribing that much? You know, that's the big deal. There's a lot of things that have been cited as causes for it. It's really kind of a perfect storm of things that came together in the early 90s and rode out for about 15 or 20 years, that storm, that all came together. Some of it was increased recognition of pain and under-treatment of pain. When I was in school, that was the mantra. We're barbarians, we're opiophobic, we're not treating people's pain, we need to treat their pain. That was the thing. I mean, years and years of that. That was the message, banging that drum for a decade. But that's what we need to be doing. And a lot of people got trained that way, myself included, that that's what we need to do. Pain became the fifth vital sign. People blame the Joint Commission for creating the pain was the fifth vital sign thing. It was not. It was the American Pain Society. It was a pharmaceutical company-funded foundation that basically launders money and tries to create messaging for why you have a condition and what you should do about it. It's an old trick. But it was done to get people convinced and doctors convinced that pain needs to be the fifth vital sign. That level. So it's not just that we need, you know, not that we need to pay attention to people's pain, but it has to be a vital sign. And that drove a lot of thinking. So did the Joint Commission, though, come in and said you have to assess and address people's pain. You have to have a plan in place at your organization for assessing and addressing people's pain. You have to have some sort of measurement. You have to have, you know, there are certain things the Joint Commission did do. I'm not letting them off the hook. But they did not use the words fifth vital sign. You know, they just said, hey, you need to do a better job of responding to what they believed in during that decade. We need to assess pain better. We need to treat it better. So you can't ignore it. I agree, it's well-motivated, but it was another factor that led people to dial up how do we really, really focus on pain. Then we had a lot of things like satisfaction measures. People get out of hospitals or out of healthcare settings and get surveyed, especially in Medicare and Medicaid, about how their care was provided. And those surveys become translated into better rates of reimbursement for providers. So if a hospital wants higher CAHPS scores, higher survey scores to get better reimbursement, we'll just have a little tacit policy that everybody that comes in gets offered Vicodin. And I know people who work in emergency rooms that said that was exactly the policy until very recently. Anyone who comes in, you say, how are you doing? How's your pain? Do you want some Vicodin? Three questions. Because they're driven by those. They want higher CAP scores, higher reimbursement. The hospital's going to do better. In a perverse way, that's a terrible perverse incentive to encourage people to just write an opioid prescription. And a lot of docs have cited that as that was another pressure. And so that was at play. Drug company advertising and promotion. In case you're not aware of companies like Purdue Pharma and how successful they are and how good of marketers they are, you should read stuff like in the Atlantic Monthly and the New York Times and those kinds of things about the Sadler family and marketing OxyContin. And despite the fact they'll pay out a judgment, they've been sued for this kind of stuff. False and misleading advertising. The drugs aren't act. They don't act as long as they say they're going to act. Well, they paid out a $650 million judgment. We're done. We've been moving right along. Then run into $650 million to them almost makes no difference. So it's, you know, very successful marketing, though. And we did this marketing, peer-to-peer marketing, doctor-to-doctor, and they're very good at it. And the guy that did this, the patriarch of the Sadler family, did this with drugs like Valium and Librium and OxyContin, and has been known as the most successful drug marketer the world has ever seen. And that's very successful. So it's, they do stuff that works. You know, it's really, they're very good at getting out there and promoting their products and creating markets and creating that demand and doing that. Practitioners, and most of them will admit, they were not well-trained in pharmacology in general. They're not pharmacologists, and much less opioid pharmacology. Even less so, if any, in addiction. What does addiction look like? How do I diagnose addiction? Or how do I treat addiction? Zero. You know, virtually every doc will tell you in med school they didn't get that. They just don't get that. Maybe some addictionologists got that, or a few psychiatrists got that, or whatever, but this is just not taught. Now it is. You know, where I'm over at the med school dean's office, like I'm chaining myself to your door, and until you put this in the curriculum, I don't leave. And so that's the kind of stuff we're doing with them. And they've changed their curriculum. Dental school is different. Pharmacy, nursing, medicine, all of them are different now. Practitioners coming out are trained in this stuff a lot better. I wouldn't say they're experts, but they are aware of better pain management. They're aware of what addiction looks like. They're aware of, hey, MAT can be done in primary care and other settings. So we need to do that. So that's great, but you know, 125 new docs a year, you do the math and how many it's going to need to do to get out there and fill out the workforce. And it's going to have to be people like my brother, who's a dentist, and they're going to have to die off and have another generation of people take over before all of medical practice just gets changed. It takes a long time to change medical practice. And then, as I mentioned, the drugs are much more powerful than people think. You go to the medicine cabinet, it can't be that bad. I really can't get addicted if it's Percocet from the medicine cabinet. Still a myth that exists, still exists with patients. I ask people that all the time and still get the same answer. No, heroin will do that.
Fentanyl might do that, but Vicodin won't do that. Yeah, it will. Absolutely, it will. And then there's still a strong black market, about $1 a milligram, some places as high as $2 a milligram for a morphine, one morphine milligram equivalent on the street. So a 20 milligram oxy fetches $20 to $30. So people, to get these prescriptions, even if they don't need them, or even if they do need them, it's a lot easier to get, if I can get 80 or 90 or 100 oxys, sell those, buy heroin, rinse and repeat. And that's a very common thing that you'll see, because it's just much, and people would rather use prescribed opioids, a consistent dose, they know what they're getting, it's much preferred, but the cost is so high, four times, five times higher than the street price of heroin. So it's a tough one. So how does this all start? People have a lot of different theories about how it starts. I'll give you the most common vectors that we see from where people that end up in trouble, and you work backwards and ask them, how did you start this kind of stuff? Colorado's not the highest state in the country in terms of how many opioids we prescribe. We're always in the 35th to 45th state in terms of opioids per capita, which is encouraging. Everybody uses way too many of them. So I say, great, we're below average, but everybody, the entirety of the curve is shifted way too high. So even being the best one is like, okay, we're the best of the worst, and I don't know how that makes us look, but it's kind of what we are. We're among the better of all the ones that stink. So, yes. The whole country, we just use too many opioids in the United States. 80%, almost 80% of the world's opioids are consumed in the United States. 98% of the world's oxycodone is consumed in the United States. Nobody in the world uses OxyContin but us.